I'd like to turn the presentation over to Simon Mahan, SAIS Renewable Energy Manager.
Thanks, Sarah. Can you hear me all right?
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Great. Okay. So as Aaron said, I'm Simon Mahan. I am the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy Renewable Energy Manager, and I focus primarily on wind energy and encouraging wind energy development throughout the Southeast. But today's webinar is focusing on some of the myths around wind energy, and I'm going to do my best to run through a bunch of them, but I understand there are many, many more than what I'll be able to cover in this next hour, and I'm sure there are even plenty more that I've never even heard of. But generally, the myths about wind energy can be grouped into four major categories and then a fifth kind of miscellaneous area. So the general issues that folks have or concerns or questions about wind energy include the aesthetics or how wind farms look and behave in the environment, the health, potential health impacts from wind farms, the costs of the electricity coming from wind energy, and, of course, the environmental impacts of wind energy. And I didn't place these at random. These are generally the order that people recognize as being most important to them with regard to building a brand-new wind farm in their backyard. Can we go to the next slide? So there is some organized opposition at the national level with regard to wind farm development. Below is listed just some of these organizations. One of them I'd like to point out, the American Wind Energy Opposition, or AWEO, is very close to a trade association for the wind energy industry, the American Wind Energy Association, AWEA. And so it's kind of funny that they chose the very similar acronyms. But, of course, the picture is the famous image of Don Quixote, who ran around the Spanish countryside slaying windmills many, many centuries ago. But there is a coordinated effort. But believe it or not, about 89% of Americans believe that increasing the amount of wind energy that this nation gets is actually a good idea. So the opposition is organized, but they're very, very small. Next. So just, again, kind of divvying the arguments up a bit more here. Under aesthetics, folks are concerned about the turbine size, how ugly they are, or how they perceive them to be ugly, the noise of the turbines, potential tourism impacts, or property values. And throughout this presentation, I've borrowed a lot of these cartoons that some of the opposition groups have developed to kind of show what they're saying and how they're saying it. But I do want to note here that there have been some studies done that show that aesthetic perceptions, both positive and negative, about wind farms are tend to be the strongest single influence on an individual's attitudes with regard to the wind projects. And so these tend to be some of the most emotionally charged issues that people want answered, and rightfully so. Next slide. And also, throughout the rest of this presentation, you may also notice that I'll be comparing wind turbines to a lot of other things, particularly in the energy realm. And it's meant to strike a comparison of what we have under the status quo, where we have a lot of coal generation, we have a lot of natural gas and nuclear generation, but not very much wind energy. And so if you look at wind energy kind of on its own without any sort of comparison, it's understandable how someone could be so concerned about something. And that's what a lot of the opposition groups are depending on. They're depending on people not doing their research and not comparing wind turbines to anything else. So the very first thing here is just aesthetics, the size of the turbines. Wind turbines can be up to 400 feet tall. That's taller than a football field. So a very large structure. But alternatively, if you can see the slide here, the picture next to it is this gargantuan machine that looks definitely out of some sort of science fiction horror show, and it's a real machine. It actually exists. It's about 300 feet tall and over 700 feet long, and what it does is it mines coal in Germany. And so that coal miner, that one single coal miner, is what Germany has to mine some of their coal. And the point of this is to show that structures that we use to generate our electricity are massive, and they're massive for a reason. They're not massive just because we want to build things bigger. It's because when you build things bigger, they are much more efficient in terms of cost to get the energy out. And so that one turbine, while it may be very large, it can power about 300 or 400 homes. So it's a very substantial amount of energy. And by making these products and these turbines so large, you can actually have a lower cost of electricity, which goes into another thing that I'll talk about here later. Next. Another issue with regard to aesthetics is, what is this going to do to tourism? We didn't have wind turbines before. We're going to have them now. And actually, the few studies that have been done that look at scientifically verifiable data with regard to tourism and wind farms, it actually suggests that wind farms can enhance tourism. And what part of the reason is because they're a novelty. They're something very interesting. And in fact, I have even participated in wind turbine tourism when my family and I went to a bed and breakfast in Petersburg, West Virginia, just a couple of years ago. It's a beautiful area in West Virginia, lots of mountains, beautiful fresh streams. But from this one particular bed and breakfast, you can see this amazing wind farm off in the distance. And it's one of the few locations in a small town that you can actually see the turbines from where you're staying. To counter that, on the opposite side of this slide, I've got a big picture of what looks to be like a giant dump truck. And if you look in the very lower left-hand corner, you can actually see the size of a person, a human being. That's actually the world's or the U.S.'s largest electrical coal digger. it's called Big Brutus. And this was actually used in Kansas for many decades to dig up coal. And now it's been retired, and it actually serves as a tourist attraction. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that wind farms, too, are also going to be serving to increase tourism. Next slide. The next is much more of a subjective issue, whether wind turbines are ugly or if they're pretty. This kind of argument, there you can't definitively state on facts that turbines are beautiful or they're ugly or smokestacks are beautiful or ugly. It's a matter of personal perception. And so if you simply look at the turbines and think to yourself, you know what, that might be a pretty turbine, it can radically change how you actually think and actually view the turbines. And you can do the same with a smokestack, which I've countered here. Now, personally, I think smokestacks and the billowing, disgusting, sulfur-laden smoke that's coming out of them can be very, very ugly. But in a certain light, if you look at them a certain way, and if you say to yourself, you know what, that might actually be beautiful, you can begin to change your perception on that. And so ugliness is a very subjective issue with regards to wind turbines. Next. Noise. This has been a great concern from folks, especially from older wind turbines that were developed in the 1980s. Back then, we didn't have a lot of the technology now and a lot of the lubricants and a lot of the mechanics necessary to make the turbines quieter. And what it is actually is the noise from the wind turbines, if it's making a grinding noise or if it's making a squeaking noise, that's an inefficiency. And so wind turbine developers and manufacturers do their best to reduce those inefficiencies by making sure that the turbines are properly maintained. And so what this chart is showing is from a modern turbine. Modern turbines are much less noisy than the older turbines from the 1980s or even the 1990s. And what's happening here with the picture is the further away you get from the turbine, the quieter things are. And so basically, once you get far enough out, it's blending into the ambient background noise. And it's not that big of an inconvenience or not that big of an annoyance. And while we're on the subject of sound, keep in mind that coal and natural gas mining can also be very noisy. The mining process uses explosives to completely remove mountains, the trains that transport coal and block up your morning commute. So you need to keep things in mind that the wind turbines are quieter than what they have been before, but also they're more likely to be quieter than the mining operations of some of these other forms of energy. Next. So another concern is that they're so ugly that they're going to decline property values, and so people don't want them nearby because they're concerned that their home values are going to be decreased. I mean, it makes complete sense that you would be concerned about your home value. However, a recent study conducted by the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, it's the most extensive study completed on evaluating the effects of turbines on home sale prices. The result was that there is statistically no evidence that proves wind turbines harm sale prices. Meanwhile, alternatively, the other picture up here is the alternative that many citizens in Japan are having to live with right now. Many citizens around the Fukushima nuclear disaster simply cannot go home. It's impossible for them to go home at this point. All right, so that's a broad brush of some of the aesthetic issues. Now we'll move on to health. These are some of the more general health concerns. There sure are plenty of others that I may have not mentioned here, but these tend to be the most prevalent. Next. So the first issue here is something called wind turbine syndrome. The nomenclature for this newfound issue it came about in 2009 after someone published a book on the issue that claims that low-frequency sounds from the turbines are causing people to become sick. But what the book doesn't do is it doesn't show that the symptoms are actually because of the sound or because people who hated the wind farms before they showed up are just angry because they are still now there. So that the symptoms are not necessarily because of the sound themselves. The book is claimed to be peer-reviewed, but it wasn't reviewed or even published in a legitimate medical journal. Anyone can publish a book and get a few people to write some accolades on it. But also, if sound really is a problem, you can move the turbines away from people's homes, and certainly you do want to move them away so they don't bother people. And minimum setbacks for turbines and sound levels can be legislated, just like many municipalities have around the country. And again, alternatively, this picture up here just reminds us that people actually do get sick from coal-fired power plants, asthma, premature deaths, mercury toxicity, black lung disease. These are actual real documented health conditions compared to something that may or may not exist. So another issue is something called shadow flicker, and what this is if you were to stand underneath a turbine on a sunny day and the turbine is spinning, you get flashes of shadows passing over your face, when the shadows pass, you get the sun back, and so that's called a shadow flicker. It's very similar, just like in this picture, of if you were to drive down a road that's tree-lined in the middle of the afternoon or late in the evening, the sun's shining on the trees, and you're passing by these shadows at a rapid rate with these trees. It's a lot slower for the wind turbines, the shadows that do fall on the ground. The blades are moving slower, so you're not getting that rapid flicker that you're getting along the highway. But the claim here is that the shadow flicker causes epilepsy, something like a strobe light would trigger an epileptic seizure. But as you can see, it's very similar to what we're seeing already in nature with regards to these tree-lined roads. And the picture on the left is actually a modeled version of a wind turbine smack in the middle and how many hours per year are expected to experience a flicker event. The yellow areas of the picture on the left, the one that kind of looks like a butterfly, the yellow areas are about 400 meters from the wind turbine, and shadow flickers is expected to be in that yellow area in total about 100 to 300 hours per year. Several model ordinances around the country and municipalities require a certain amount of distance from the occupied homes, and as you can see, the further away you get from the turbine, the fewer number of hours of shadow flicker affect the area. So just to sum this one up, there hasn't been any conclusive evidence that shadow flicker has caused or does cause any epileptic seizures, and you can move the turbines away. So this next slide is blade ice throw. Turbines are specifically designed to shut down when ice forms. This is typically a health concern up in the further north, where turbines are frequently in icy or snowy conditions. And the concern here is that when a turbine stops, when the blade stops spinning, the ice accumulates on the blades, and then when the wind picks back up, the concern is that the blades fling the ice so far that it can hit a person or a house or property or something, landing thousands of feet away. But the technology within the turbines is very advanced, and when ice accumulates, and it does accumulate, when too much ice accumulates on the turbine can sense that and shut itself down and will not operate. It's very similar to your ceiling fan. If your ceiling fan is out of whack, it will wobble uncontrollably, and if it gets too bad, it can even fall out of your ceiling. And it's the same with the turbine. So it's in the best interest of the turbine manufacturers and the turbine operators to stop that sort of wobble early on, detect it early on, and make sure that those turbines are safe and operating in such a fashion that they won't destroy themselves. The picture on the right is a study completed in Swiss Alps showing a distribution of ice throws from wind turbines. And what this shows is actually that fewer than 5% of the ice throws were greater than 260 feet away. So maybe, not even the height of the turbine itself. Whereas most wind turbines here in the U.S. are required to be set back about 1,000 feet away from an occupied building. So it minimizes the risk of this ice throw concern. Next. There's another concern called electromagnetism, and you may have heard this with regard to cell phones or proximity to transmission lines, but this concern is based on what electromagnetic fields do to the human body and whether or not those are carcinogenic. In this regard, wind turbines are a source of electromagnetic fields, sure, but basically anything that uses electricity or has a radio emitter has an electromagnetic field. This argument is also, like I mentioned, used against transmission lines and cell phones. And being further away from the wind turbines reduces your exposure to electromagnetic fields. And on top of that, there's no evidence that people have gotten harm from electromagnetic fields from wind turbines themselves. This is a less well-known concern called stray voltage. Stray voltage occurs when electricity doesn't follow the normal path through a transmission line or an electrical line, but instead energizes the ground around a grounded wire. There is no evidence that turbines cause stray voltage, and I'll point out this picture on the right here of this turbine just looking like it's blowing up and electricity shooting everywhere. That's Photoshopped. That does not exist. It's not real. You can tell just by virtue of how the smoke is coming off of this thing, but it's Photoshopped. It's completely false. And that stray voltage is typically a problem on the customer side of the electric equation. It's usually not a generator-induced problem. It's not a power plant problem. Once electricity from a wind turbine enters the transmission and distribution grids, there's nothing special about that electricity that would cause customers to be overly susceptible to that stray voltage. So they don't cause the stray voltage problem. All right, now that we've kind of looked at some of the aesthetics and health issues, let's move on to some of the costs. These tend to be arguments where the rubber really hits the road with folks. How much is this actually going to cost to build wind farms? So let's move to the next slide and just answer it very quickly. It's cheaper than many of the alternatives. Wind energy is much cheaper nowadays to build than new coal or new nuclear power. And this argument that renewables and particularly wind energy is really a relic. It's an old argument, usually without any sort of qualification. They don't usually say, it's expensive and this is how expensive it is. They just usually say, it's expensive and leave it at that, which isn't true anymore. The issue here is if you were to compare the cost of, say, keeping an old car that you've already paid for versus building and purchasing a brand new car from the dealership, there'd be no question. It's cheaper to keep the old car, but certainly that old car has some features in it that aren't good, and that's particularly the case with these older power plants, the older coal plants in particular, that are emitting a lot of pollutants. And the same is true with comparing wind energy to already existing generation. The coal plants, they've been paid for. They've been around for 30 or 40 years, so it's cheaper for the utilities to just keep buying the coal for fuel rather than to build a brand new generation unit. But when you compare a new wind farm to building a new coal plant, it's no contest. Wind farms are usually the cheapest form that you can get compared to a coal plant, and they do compete very, very well with a natural gas plant. You need to keep in mind here on this slide, the prices reflected in the slide are for new power plants, and the price for natural gas, coal, and nuclear energy do not include externalities that are passed on to society as a whole, such as the polluted air and the wasted water and the climate change impacts as well. So the costs are actually much lower for wind. Another issue is variability, the so-called wind doesn't blow all the time, so you can't rely on it. This is actually a cost argument because all generators, all forms of electric power in the United States are required by law to have a certain amount of backup generation just in case a large power plant were to suddenly go offline. If there was an explosion at a natural gas power plant, or there wasn't enough water for a nuclear power plant, or if there was a hurricane coming through and really messing up the railroads for a coal plant, these utilities are required to have a certain amount of excess capacity in the background. And so the argument here then goes that, well, you need to run a natural gas plant 100% of the time back behind a wind power plant just to firm it up, which isn't the case. And to prove this, wind energy actually provides about 15% of Texas's total electricity. Texas is a very big state that consumes a lot of energy. And wind energy provides about 20% of the electricity in Iowa. And at times, wind has actually been known to provide up to half of the electricity in countries like Spain, particularly during windy months like March. And a study by the Department of Energy estimates that the U.S. could generate 20% of our electricity from wind for about 50 cents per wind pair per year. So the wind isn't so unreliable that we can't use it in our generation mix. And not only that, we could use a fairly substantial amount of it, at least up to 20%, without significantly increasing ratepayer costs. And the reason behind that is because the prices of natural gas and coal and the regulatory costs of running these traditional power plants is going up, whereas wind farms just don't have those costs to deal with. You have that stable cost of a wind farm over the course of its lifetime, which can be up to 20 years or so. Next. So the next issue that folks usually bring up with costs is, oh, we need to bring in all these new transmission lines, and those transmission lines are big and bulky and expensive, and it takes a long time to permit them and get them through. But in order to do wind, we need a lot of transmission, which isn't necessarily the case. It's usually a case of folks look at a wind map and see that the best wind resources of the country lie in the middle of the country, far away from population loads. But upgrading the transmission lines to get that wind energy to the population's loads, to us here in the southeast, it can be very price competitive, especially because wind is so cheap in the Midwest. And for an example of this, there's a company called Clean Line Energy that's proposing a very large transmission line connecting the plains to the southeast to ship wind energy over to us. And they can actually, they estimate that the electricity generated by the wind farms transmitted over the transmission lines is to be about 5.5 to 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour, so cheaper than new coal. Now, that's a brand new transmission line, and comparatively, there's recently an agreement signed by Alabama Power to purchase a good slug of wind energy from Oklahoma using already existing transmission lines. And we can do that to a certain extent, but certainly to get the large-scale amount of wind energy, we will have to have some additional transmission lines, but they're not that expensive. Next. Now, on the cost issue, one of the things that is particularly contentious nowadays is folks are happy to point out that renewable energies receive subsidies, and because of that, we need to marginalize their use. But as this graphic should pretty clearly show, the amount of subsidies received by the renewable energy industry as a whole is small compared to what oil and natural gas and coal and this graph even parses it out for carbon capture and sequestration. The amount is small compared to what the other traditional forms of generation have received, and they're still receiving. Many of these tax write-offs for the big companies still exist, even though they're making record profits, and they don't need those subsidies anymore. Meanwhile, renewable energy resources that have a lot to give back in terms of the efficiencies that can be generated through additional research and development and through increases in the economy of scale, they're receiving a very small amount of subsidies. So this slide just goes to show that everything receives subsidies, and renewables are basically receiving the short end of the stick of this. So we've talked about the health concerns, the aesthetics, and the costs, and now we'll talk about the environmental aspects. And these are some of the most pervasive environmental concerns about wind farms. Next. And perhaps the most pervasive concern is about what is this going to do to birds. Back when wind turbines were very, very new, especially in the 1970s, folks didn't really realize how wind turbines interacted with birds. And so what was happening was there's this one particular site in California where the developer was using a old turbine from the 1970s that used lattice work that looks an awful lot like a cell phone tower to prop up the wind turbine up on the top. And they were creating these nice concrete pads on the ground. And what they were doing out in the middle of this area called Altamont Pass was they were actually creating perfect raptor habitat, birds of prey. And what was happening was the raptors were perching on the lattice work, and the concrete foundations were actually being dug out underneath by nearby rodents. And so they were creating a whole ecosystem for raptors that hadn't existed before. On top of that, the blades spun so quickly that when they were reaching top speed, you could see right through them. They didn't appear to exist. And so when the birds of prey were flying around, they were looking down at their prey, at the rodents that are near the turbines. They were not paying attention to what was going on in front of them, and they quite a few of them have died when they impact the turbines themselves or the blades. Fortunately, things have changed quite a lot since then. There have been a lot of environmental studies done that show where birds tend to congregate, what birds tend to interact with wind turbines. The turbines themselves, the technology has changed. We no longer use the lattice work to build the wind turbines, so there's no place for these raptors to perch. And the blades actually spin slow enough that you can see them spin, and so you're not basically running into a whirlwind of blades. But also, I do want to point out here that wind turbines are actually safer than much of the alternatives. There's a great study published a couple of years ago in a journal that found that coal-fired power plants actually kill about 18 times as many birds as wind farms do, or wind turbines do. And the reason why is because in order to get the coal to burn in our power plants, you have to go through a lot of nasty mining processes, which is detrimental to the habitats of many birds, and in such a fashion that those habitats will never be the same, and in particular, mountaintop removal and wastewater leaching from these mines. It's particularly dangerous and toxic to the birds that are nearby. So not only is wind energy safer than what we already are using for perhaps about a majority of our electricity, wind turbines are much safer than many of the other things that we use in our daily lives. They're safer than communications towers, than oil rigs that birds tend to fly into, power lines. And the number one killer of of birds is buildings. And certainly if you've been around in a large city before, you've seen birds strike a building and die because of it. And it's simply because the birds are flying into the structures. And so wind turbines are not the greatest threat to birds as some may perceive them. And in fact, they can actually help some bird populations, especially get us off coal and stave off the worst effects of climate change. This is a fairly new concern about bats. Bat populations have not plummeted because of wind turbines. People like to draw a linear correlation between the two. Bat populations have been declining just recently because of something called white nose syndrome. And the scientists are working very diligently to try and figure out what's causing that, but they just don't know yet. Meanwhile, there have been reported deaths of bats at wind turbines, at wind farms, and there have even been studies that show that you can reduce the amount of bat mortality by stopping the blades of a wind turbine when the blades are spinning and not generating electricity. When the wind speeds are very, very low, the blades will spin and not generate electricity. And those tend to be the times when the bats are being hit by the blades. So if you just simply stop those blades, you can reduce bat mortality by up to 90%. So it's a very good way to help preserve bats. Next. So this is kind of an odd argument that some folks have, that wind turbines don't actually cut CO2 emissions. And what they do is they say, well, if you look at the global trend in CO2 emissions, it just keeps going up, and we're building wind farms, so clearly nothing's happening. But what they're ignoring is the fact that wind turbines are not generating any new emissions, and if those wind turbines were not built, something else would have been built, probably a natural gas power plant or maybe a coal plant. And effectively, what wind turbines are doing is, while we haven't been able to stop CO2 increase, they have reduced the speed at which it is increasing. And ultimately, the goal is to get off of these fossil fuels. And so you need a zero carbon alternative, which wind energy can be a part of that. Another concern is what are wind farms going to do to the marine environment whenever you start building offshore wind farms? And in Europe, where they've had offshore wind farms for 20 years, they've done a lot of environmental studies. They're much better at environmental studies and precautionary principles over in Europe than what we are here. They've actually shown that the wind farms act as artificial reefs, and they can actually benefit the local biodiversity and attract fish and species to the turbines themselves. And you have to keep in mind on top of that, wind turbines, when they don't spill like an oil rig. And so this cartoon, you know, it says the wind spill from the offshore turbine accident has reached the shore, and it shows that it's a nice breezy day. Another issue folks bring up is that wind turbines just use a vast amount of land, and so we shouldn't be using wind turbines. But the reality is that they use a minimal amount of land, and the land that they do use can be converted back to its original purpose, unlike a coal-fired power plant or a coal mine. The two pictures here, the one in the lower right-hand corner, is a set of about 5 wind turbines. You can see these images are from Google Earth. You can look these up if you'd like. You can see just the shadows of the wind turbines and the access road connecting them through this forest. But the picture on the left shows you what this wind farm's up against. The wind farm now is in the lower right-hand corner, so you have that very thin line. But the rest of this structure here is structure to take care of a coal-fired power plant. And even the lake itself was built and designed to run this coal-fired power plant. You've got slurry ponds that you most likely won't be able to clean up back to 100% of what the natural environment was. The lake is there for however long the coal plant's going to be there. So the land use for this wind farm in particular is minimal, especially when you compare it to the coal plant that it's right next to. Okay, so these are the miscellaneous arguments, and we'll try to rush through these just a bit so I can answer any questions. So we'll go to the next slide here. There's an issue about wind turbines and how they're going to affect national security, because there is some concern about how wind turbines interface with radar. However, the Department of Defense has been working with wind turbine developers and manufacturers to ensure that that doesn't happen. But not only that, if you compare wind farms to, say, a nuclear power plant, there's a huge national security risk with regards to nuclear and fissile material. Next. There's also this older concern that We're building all these wind turbines, but they're all from China, or they're all from some other country, which isn't the case anymore. A long time ago, it was the case. We were importing more of our components for wind turbines. But nowadays, we're using about 60% of the components that go into a turbine are manufactured here in the USA. And in fact, SACES, we have a blog series and quite a few fact sheets that go to show that we actually have quite a few manufacturers here in the Southeast that build the components that go into wind farms, not only here in the U.S., but they manufacture the stuff and then export it to the global market as well. So our domestic manufacturing is actually benefiting the international market as well. Next. This is a bit of a more difficult argument to understand, that the rare earth minerals that go into building a wind turbine they're rare, and because of that, it's going to cause some sort of bottleneck on wind turbines. But the thing is, rare earth minerals are used in a lot of different items, in your computers, in your iPods, hybrids, electric cars, batteries. We have a lot of different things that are using rare earth minerals, so they're not that rare. And the one particular metal or mineral that folks are concerned about deals with the magnets that are in the generator for the wind turbine themselves. But the thing is, wind turbines don't have to use that particular type of mineral. It's just better for a specific type of wind generator. There are different technologies that can be used that don't even use this type of rare earth mineral. So we can use the different technologies to avoid this, but not only that, it's really not that big of a deal. Next. This argument stems off of some fun math that people like to have with regards to how wind farms and renewable energy at large deal with BOBs. And there have been a few studies, very, very few, that say, you know, if you build wind farms, it kills a lot of jobs, which is not the case. Renewable energy is one of the few industries that has been hiring throughout the entire recession. And just last year, some 75,000 people were employed by the wind industry. Meanwhile, traditional coal and oil jobs have been declining, and especially if you don't count the jobs created by the BP oil spill. As you can see, there's a lot of jobs created by the BP oil spill, but also you kill a lot of jobs with that as well, fishing industries and tourism industries as well. Natural disasters do pose a unique risk to wind farms, but it's not unique to all sources of electric generation. Last year, when Hurricane Irene raked the East Coast, we asked a lot of wind farms and wind turbine owners up the mid-Atlantic who have turbines operating, you know, how did they fare during the storm? And we wrote a blog about it, and it got a lot of great attention. And what we found was that the turbines did just fine through the storm. They shut down when they were supposed to. They're designed to shut down to protect themselves. And they started back up when they were also supposed to. But what we also found was that nuclear power plants had to shut down when Irene came even within 300 miles of the nuclear reactors. And it takes a lot longer to shut those down and start them back up. But also, coal and nuclear are particularly susceptible to flooding events and disruption for coal and natural gas, at least, during hurricane events also occurs. And so what I'm trying to say here is that we can build wind farms that can withstand hurricane-force winds, but at the end of the day, there's going to be some form of natural disaster that comes by and destroys it. I mean, whatever Mother Nature throws at us, we're just going to be at its mercy one way or another. But that's not any different than other forms of electrical generation as well. Next. All right, so this is the last one on here. This argument is just made very quickly and simply by folks that use it. It's that wind turbines will slow the planet down. And the thinking behind this is the wind turbines are sticking up in the air, and it's slowing it's catching the wind, which is slowing the planet. Kind of like a big parachute would slow a paratrooper down. The problem with this, though, is that the planet turns independently from the wind. The planet turning is causing the wind to move in conjunction with the sun. The sun is ultimately the cause of why the winds are moving from here to there. And so the planet isn't going to slow down because we stick up a few turbines here and there. And in fact, the mountains, the moon, and the sun are likely to be the only things that can really speed or slow the planet up in conjunction with the inner workings of the entire planet. Again, these turbines, they're maybe, you know, up to 300 or 400 feet tall, and we certainly have many, many buildings that are taller than that, but you don't hear this argument with regards to those buildings usually. So this argument tends to be a bit spurious. So hopefully that will clear that one up. Final slide is just our website and our blog. Certainly please visit it. We have a lot of great information on the website and the blog with regards to wind energy. I did my best to kind of run through the nuts and bolts of a lot of these misconceptions and concerns about wind farms, and how we might go about to mitigate some of those. But I am interested in hearing any of the questions that folks may have typed over to Aaron. And again, if you have a question, you can use your control panel to write Aaron a question, and she can ask me. And I'll turn it over to Aaron.
Great. Thanks, Simon. Let me look through here. Okay, we have one One comment, this is the question, one comment I received from a state legislator about wind energy off the coast of North Carolina was that the tourism board was against seeing them along the coast. I responded that they are quite far out off the horizon and they would not impact the view from the beaches. So how is the North Carolina legislature responding to the idea, or are they owned by Duke and Constellation Energy?
Well, with some of these, you're absolutely right. With regards to these offshore wind farms, you can build them far enough offshore that folks won't see them. And if that's the concern, you can build them that far. But I would really encourage you, there's a bit of great research done by the University of Delaware that shows that tourism increases with wind turbine development offshore. And it's, again, it's because it's a novelty, it's a curiosity, people are very interested in it. And in fact, something like half the respondents in their survey said that they would even be willing to pay to take a boat out to go see these things because they're fascinating. Not only that, they're going to be artificial reefs, and so they're going to be great diving opportunities and even great fishing opportunities, which I'm a fisherman, so I'm very excited about the opportunities of fishing off of a wind turbine. But certainly it's just a matter of, you know, being able to provide accurate information to these folks so they can make a good decision on their own. But you're absolutely right. You can move the turbines far enough offshore so folks don't see them.
Great. Another question we have here, and you may have mentioned this, what is the average lifespan of a modern wind turbine?
The usual lifespan is expected to be 20 years, and in fact, many turbine manufacturers provide a warranty over the lifespan of their turbines to protect them. But we've even seen turbines that are still operating today in California that were built in the 1970s and the 1980s. And so 20 years is the expected lifespan, but they can certainly live longer than that.
Great. And is it much more expensive to place turbines at sea versus on land?
Yes, offshore wind turbines are more expensive, but they counteract that expense in a couple ways. One, the winds are just much greater offshore, so they're generating a lot more electricity. And another really great benefit that utilities particularly love with offshore wind farms, or they will ultimately end up loving them, is that there's something called a sea breeze effect. You may have experienced it if you're on the beach in the middle of the afternoon. You tend to get a bit of a breeze coming off the ocean, and it's because the warmed up land mass, the air from that is traveling over on top of the ocean, and it's quickly being filled back up with cooler ocean air. And so it's generating wind, and you can capture that and create electricity at that during the peak part of the day, which is when the utilities really like to have that extra boost of electricity. So it can really offset the extra cost by being more steady, more reliable, and providing electricity at the peak part of the day.
Okay. Let's see. We have one more question here. I represent an interest from Suwannee, the University of the South. My question is a two-part question. Is now a good time to get into wind energy, or should we wait for stronger technology, slower wind speed, or smaller turbines? The second part is in regards to rate of return on wind investments. Is it wiser for us in southeastern Tennessee to build a turbine to help power our campus of 1,500 students, or invest in wind farms in areas with greater consistent wind, like a wind farm in Indiana?
Well, and Aaron, I'm going to have to have you read back to me that second part of the question, but I'll try to answer the first part.
Okay,
the
great.
Wind turbine technology has reduced in cost greatly even over these past 4 or 5 years or so, and that's particularly why we're seeing a lot more interest here in the Southeast to build wind farms here. For the longest time, the Southeast was simply written off as an undevelopable area because people didn't know or didn't have the technology to tap our wind energy resource, particularly onshore. But now, as technology has advanced, we've got taller turbines, which can reach greater winds and greater wind speeds. There's new advanced composite designs for the blades themselves and different types of gearboxes that can increase the amount of electricity that comes out of the turbine. Overall, just making wind turbines more efficient and more cost-effective. So the technology has advanced greatly, even, like I said, in the past 4 or 5 years or so. And so now is a good time for anybody to be looking at wind energy, particularly these large-scale devices, to generate lots and lots of electricity. But any time is good to look towards a renewable energy future as opposed to staying here in the status quo. And Aaron, could you reread that second part of the question, please?
I sure can. The second part is in regards to rate of return on wind investments. Is it wiser for us in southeastern Tennessee to build a turbine to help power our campus of 1,500 students or invest in wind farms in areas with greater consistent wind, like a wind farm in Indiana?
Well, that's an interesting question, and there's a lot of different variables that would go into it, so I'm not willing to say one or the other just here on the phone without crunching some additional numbers, but typically it's you have a cheaper resource of wind energy, particularly in the Midwest. Indiana does have a little bit more wind resource, a stronger wind resource than what we do here in the Southeast. But when you look at the costs of electricity, there needs to be a lot of different things that go into the equation, I would argue at least. I think there would be a very real benefit to having a wind turbine at or near a college campus so people could interact with it, so they could learn about it, so they could perform experiments on it, so they could test it out, so they could perform training on it. And so there's a lot of different things that could go into the benefits that are coming out of that wind turbine that aren't simply, you know, dollars and cents, not just, you know, 5 cents per kilowatt hour or 10 cents per kilowatt hour or whatever the ultimate cost is going to be. And so it's just a matter of what is your ultimate goal? Is your ultimate goal to completely be powered by wind and that's your only goal? Or is your goal more holistic and you want to be powered by wind, but you want to be able to extract more knowledge out of that wind turbine as well? So it's a very complex question.
We have time for maybe one more question. What is the max sea depth to place a turbine, realistically?
Oh, could you say that again? I'm sorry.
What is the maximum sea depth to place a turbine?
Speed set? Is that what you said?
The sea depth.
Sea depth.
Sorry.
My apologies.
Okay.
So right now, like I said, Europe has had offshore wind turbines installed for the past 20 years, and the current technology that's commercially available, if you had $1 billion and you wanted to spend it and you wanted to go through the permitting process and get a big wind farm built, it tends to be that the depth that you want to build in is 30 meters or less, so less than 150 feet. That's with current existing technology. There's a lot of research that's being done, particularly out of Maine and Portugal, and I believe Finland, that are actually using some of the techniques from oil and natural gas offshore oil drilling to connect a structure, for our case, a wind turbine, in very deep ocean, so 600, 1,000 meters depth. Seas. And so there's a lot of research being conducted in that area, but today, within, you know, 10 years or so, I would say, you know, about 30 meters depth is where most folks are going to be looking.
Okay, great. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up here. And if your questions have not gotten answered, we will follow up with them after the webinar. There is one question I've seen a couple of times, and we will be posting the audio and the presentation for today's webinar on our website, cleanenergy.org, at the bottom of the page there. So please check that out in the next 2 days. We should have that up. And Simon, thanks so much. That was a great presentation. Thanks for sharing with us. And thank you, everyone, for your thoughtful questions and for attending today. We are very excited about our webinar series. It's a great way for us to connect with you, our members, and supporters on the critical issues we all care so much about. Please visit our website or blog to learn more. And you can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook to stay up to date on clean energy issues. And we hope you join us for our next webinar. Thanks so much.
Thank you.